My name is Eva Parekoczewska, and I have the pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Professor Agnieszka Dabowska. Agnieszka Dabowska was born in Poland, where she studied art history and French literature. Since 1989, she has been teaching European art, film, and literature at Rhode Island School of Design. Her main areas of interest are the image of women in fantasy art and literature, French surrealism, and the impact of surrealism on contemporary art. Dabowska's own experiments in surrealism has been revealed in her acclaimed book, The Dreaming Life of Leonora de la Cruz, a whimsical tale about 18th century visionary nun. French surrealists discovered Leonora Cruz 200 years after her death and worshipped her as the patron saint of the subconscious. The Dreaming Life of Leonora de la Cruz is a result of successful collaboration between Agnieszka Dabowska and collage artist Sabina Kimball. The Dreaming Life, which links text and image in parallel narratives, proves the ongoing power of the surrealist imagination to alter our perception of reality. Agnieszka Dabowska's most recent book, The Unfinished Life of Phoebe Hicks, is also illustrated by Sabina Kimball's extraordinary collages. This book is once again kind of game played with the reader and was inspired by the Victorian flirtation with the beyond. Its heroine is a woman, a spiritualist medium, living in an idyllic small town among citizens of Providence, a magical place to which the book is dedicated. Both books are not only intriguing, but also beautiful. We have some copies available here, so I would like to encourage you to stop by later on, look at them, and follow up. Agnieszka Dabowska is the author of 13 books published in Poland, US, France, Germany, Japan, and Korea. Her works of fiction have been received literary prizes, were adapted to four stages, and brought to screen in form of animated films. Among her published in Poland books, there are collections of essays and short stories, Conspirators of Imagination, Surrealism, The Whale, or Objective Chance, and Not as in Paradise, this book we have here in Polish, so you can buy it. In addition to writing and teaching, in the 1990s, Professor Dabowska produced annual school cabaret in the Rhode Island School of Design. Has curated exhibitions on surrealism art in France and Poland, and has written scripts for documentary films related to surrealism. Please help me to welcome our tonight's guest, Professor Agnieszka Dabowska, who will introduce as to Pompadour figures in the late 19th century and early 20th century in Western art.
Thank you very much. I am extremely happy to be here in Seattle, the city I haven't been in, so I am discovering it. Thank you very much to Eva who invited me, to my wonderful guides, Wanda and Christina and Katarzyna, who showed me your city, which you probably don't realize it anymore because you see it every day, but it's really spectacular. I was told by a friend in Providence that this is her most, she believes, the most beautiful city in America, and I am very much of the same opinion after spending first 2 Sundays here. So it almost feels out of proportion. precaution to talk about dark femme fatales on a, such a beautiful evening like today, but I will do it, and I hope you will find them intriguing. I'm going to show a lot of images, and we'll go rather quickly through them. But I just believe that the subject is, from the visual point of view, so extremely interesting. The more images you see, it's better. And then at the end, I will show you clips, very brief clips, 3 to 4 minutes from 4 Hollywood films with the biggest and the most dangerous vamps, such as Greta Garbo, Alena Dietrich, and others. So I tried to include quite a lot of Polish painters. Some of them are very well-known artists, some of them are lesser known, and my idea was to, not always to show the best art, actually you will see some of the very popular postcards, but the main idea was to show you the most typical, sometimes very extreme representations of women, femme fatale, in late 19th and 20th century. So we will say mostly in the time of the turn of the century. So I'm starting with just a few examples of the images which predated the femme fatale obsession, which they were mostly made in the first half of the 20th century, the time which was interested in heroines like you can see here. So often the women recuperating for sickness, sometimes about to die or dead. Ophelia was one of the very favorite heroines. This is also a quite a good example of the beautiful female body, which is just going to be medically examined. So after this mid-century predilections for traveling men, virgins, meditating nuns, pale housewives, painting beauties, and so on. The turn of the century brought a very new subject and brought the predilection for the dead sisters of those dead and dying heroines. This is one of the examples of the late 19th, early 20th century paintings, which became filled with usually dark-haired women with wild gaze and cat-like eyes made often the main viewer nervously touch their necks. Next, of course, those subjects were not only limited to the visual arts, also the poets and writers wrote about femme fatale. The first name coming to mind is, of course, Baudelaire with his symbolic poetry and his famous collection of poems, Flowers of Evils, first published in the middle 19th century. And probably no other poet described this new creation of the femme fatale better than he did in Flowers of Evil, in which very often he compared women to vampires and deadly creatures coming from the grave to hunt the men. Well, obviously, there are economical, sociological reasons behind the emergence of the femme fatale, and one of them were the changes going on in European and American cities, the huge economical changes, the fact that the cities were blooming, there was the Industrial Revolution. A lot of young women were coming from the provinces looking for jobs in the cities. Very often they would not find them and become prostitutes. So the 19th century literature is filled with the descriptions of prostitution, such heroines like Manet's Olympia, his famous painting, or Manet's Nana, which actually predated Zola's book about Nana. Zola was fascinated with Manet's painting and wrote his book about Nana. And in this very famous novel, Zola's Nana, actually all the obsessions about what was called in the 19th century female nature are present. So, for example, Nana is described as a force of destruction, a man-eating siren, an animal born to be naked, a cat, a devil, a force of nature, beast of the scriptures, etc., etc. Then another very famous heroine was, of course, Carmen. Carmen, who was first described by Mehmed, who wrote in 1845, so we are really in the middle 10th century when the image of the pale housewife was slowly changing into the dark image of a femme fatale. So he wrote his story about the immortal and immoral Carmen. This is actually a postcard with an actress playing Carmen. And the interesting thing is, those of, well, I guess all of us know the opera, that Carmen could not be Spanish, because even for a relatively liberal audience, the description of such an immoral heroine who values her freedom more than anything else would be too much. So Mehmed made her a gypsy, and a gypsy like Nana ruins men in the name of her freedom, which she values more than anything else. And actually, as you will see later when I show you the postcards, Carmen shared some characteristics with so-called new woman born in the middle of the century, and was considered also by most people confusing creature and quite a frightening new, very new type of a woman. So of course the source of the stories about femme fatales was the Bible and Greek mythology. So these are the main two sources. And starting with the Bible and with the painter whom you will see several of his paintings, Franz von Stuck, who was an extremely popular painter in this time and painted numerous versions of his Adam and Eve scenes, and later also the Greek mythological Sphinx. And obviously all those images were painted before 19th century as well, but only at the end of this decadent 19th century they became so different. So, for example, in the case of Adam and Eve, before the scene was just one of the many scenes, and Eve was not such a very important character. Then at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, she was really in the center of attention. And even in this painting, you can see that Adam, of course, is there, but he's much less important. There's more attention given to Eve, who is working in a very sensual way with this gigantic serpent and offering the red apple to Adam. So just a few more examples. This is, for example, French painter who paints her with a peacock. A peacock became a very powerful symbol in the late 19th century, in the Art Nouveau time, as of course a symbol of vanity. So this was one of the features usually associated to women. So here is Eve contemplating whether she should eat it or not. The serpent behind her and the peacock next to her. Some of the paintings would not even have Eve or Paradise or the sin in the title, but of course the viewer knew very well what was behind them. So here is so-called Viper, and of course the woman looks like more like an early 20th century modern woman, right? Modern temptress with red hair. This was also a very frequent, as you will see, very frequent features. Very often the femme fatale, the temptresses, would have red hair. Then Franz von Stuck, who was, as I said, extremely popular, and he would paint those gigantic paintings and call them often either the sin or sensuality. And he would present naked women playing with gigantic beasts, gigantic serpents, as you can see here. He would usually paint many versions of each of these paintings. And again, well, the biblical Eve, of course, is behind them. This is one of the very numerous his versions of sin, and so she is fixing her gaze in the viewers together with the beast's head next to her. Actually, Franz von Stack was one of the favorite painters of Adolf Hitler later. This is I have a big collection of postcards which I kept buying in the States and in France mostly. And this was even, I started to collect them even before the huge presence of internet in our lives. So I would go from flea market to flea market and from postcard events which happen in so many places during the weekends. And I would buy a lot of postcards. They are now much more expensive because they are so collectible, so easy to store. So I guess I got my collection at the very last moment. But this is an amazing example of a female postcard designer. There were not that many women designing postcards. She was very popular and made the whole series of similar postcards, A Woman with a Serpent. And the postcards I have were used by a French soldier writing letters to his fiancé, to his mother from the trenches during the First War. So that's the things he's describing are horrific. You know, he's talking about his friends being killed, and so he describes the life in the trenches, which we know was just a hell on earth. And he's choosing those postcards, and the postcards were extremely popular at the beginning of the 20th century. There was a huge choice of them. So my theory is that the images of the sword were so present, they were such a big part of everybody's life that people didn't really look at them with our eyes. So there was nothing unusual to write about people dying and suffering among in the trenches and choosing such images as a postcard. And well, just to keep my promise to include published postcards, so this is Franciszek Szmulko, who was a very very popular, very, very much present artist who specialized in painting women's faces and torsos. And often the models would look pretty much the same. And only one attribute would tell us who is who. So this is an apple, right? So obviously it's Eve. And that's an example I like. Harrison Fisher, who was a very important artist on this side of the ocean. And he painted mostly modern people. So men wearing sport-like outfits and modern women, slim and flapper-like. But the subject remains very much the same, right? So even though they are dressed in a 20th century fashion and they are sitting in a modern car, but still the danger remains the same, right? She's offering him the apple. So the message is that she might be a sense of troubles. Now Delilah. Delilah, Samson and Delilah, whom, as you may remember, Delilah was Samson's mistress, and Samson was a superhero, and the source of his strength was in his hair. And Delilah delivered his secret to his enemies, the Philistines, she did the cutting, she cut the hair, and they would blind him, and they got him thanks to the woman whom he loved and who betrayed him. So usually, of course, again, she was painted before 19th century, but only at the end of the 19th century, her and Samson became the only hero of the story. This is a painting by Gustave Moreau, which used to be and still is in this wonderful museum in Paris of Gustave Moreau, and Breton loved it. He used to go to this museum in the evenings and stir at the painting and wrote in his novel Communicating Vessels that for over 15 years he was in love with the eyes of Delilah. And then when he was walking in Paris, and as was the surrealist custom, to wait for the chance encounter and hoping to meet an unknown and mysterious woman, he was often looking for someone who would bring back the memory of Mahos Delilah. Sacher Masoch, in his Venus in Force, and talking about again about Polish connections, the new film by Roman Polański, which is the adaptation of Venus in Force, is definitely a film to be seen. So Sacher Masoch also described the scene between Samson and Delilah, comparing himself and all the men to Samson, saying that in effect all of us are like Samson, and we all dream to be delivered in the hands of someone like Delilah. So of course this Sacher Masoch, from whom the term sadomasochism derives, for the story of Samson and Delilah was just a perfect one for him. It's interesting to see, because of course for us, for 20th century, it's pretty much very, well, most of us, not all of us here, but a lot of us remember very well the 20th century. So it's interesting to see how often those subjects, which seem pretty much 19th century-like, but how much they are very well alive in the 20th century. So this is an example of a sculpture. The same subjects, of course, were treated by sculptors as well. And the popular critic of this time described this sculpture as a scene in which Delilah is treating her lover asleep as if she was a butcher, seizing the turkey for decapitation. So the critics' descriptions of those artworks are quite something. And this is an example again of the early 20th century painting by Max Liebermann, so more or less a realist painter who truly brings this biblical story to the here and now. Right? There are some soldiers who are looking from behind the curtain, but we can very well forget about them. And what we see, we have just this couple of two nude people in love and in bed. And just one detail that she's cutting his hair. So very much here and now. Now the next heroine who was more popular than Delilah was Judith. Judith, who was one of the famous, well, talking about the late 19th century art, decapitators. She was a very brave Jewish widow who entered the camp of her besieging army captain, and cut his head. So what she did was a truly act of courage and patriotism. It didn't have much to do with Femme Fatale, but again, the late 19th and early 20th century painters treated her as a bloodthirsty Femme Fatale. This is one of the two very famous and beautiful versions by the one of the most well-known succession Austrian artist Gustav Klimt. Often, the paintings which would be very much present in the minds of the audiences and critics and were part of exhibits, were reproduced in the catalogs, were known under two titles. So, for example, Klimt's version was sometimes reproduced as a Salome. I'm going to talk about her in a moment. So, sometimes even the same painting would have three titles: Judith, Salome, or Herodias, Salome's mother. So the three women truly merge in the minds of quite a lot of people of the time. So Judith was sometimes painted like here in this exotic for the European audience back then costume, waiting for Holofernes to come. From the description, we don't know anything about her being naked, so this is just an addition to attract the viewer. And she's having this, sporting this huge sword, which again, technically was to make the scene more dramatic, would be too difficult to sneak it into the enemy's tent. Sometimes she would be presented just as a model, right, as like a modernist model, sitting in the artist's studio, and she would have again her prop, the sword. And sometimes, again, as it was pictured by Franz von Stuck, she was more an emblem of female's dangers. Again, mute for no reason except that the painting would seem more attractive. And look, that this was made in 1926. So actually, some of the Hollywood early films with the vamps were made much earlier. So the first clip we will see very soon is from 1915. So the subjects in the painting were truly doing very, very well into the 20th century. Another example of a very modernist painting, which has actually very little to do with the most traditional way the story was described. Actually, Oppenheimer was talking before with Samson and Delilah, so to the couple in bed. So she sort of specialized in a much more sensual and erotic images such as this one. Of course, it's just pure fruit of fantasy, right, to present Judith truly enjoying this severed head, right, in her bed. He would do the same thing, even more risque with Salome and the head of John the Baptist. And talking about Salome, so no other heroine became as popular as Salome, who was the princess of Galilee. And in the Bible, there's very little attention given to her. So she's described as a tool in the hands of her mother, Herodias. And the mother, Herodias, asked her to dance the famous Dance of Seven Veils in front of her stepfather, Herod. And then when she's asked by Herod what she would like to have for her as a reward for her dance, she's asked again by her mother to ask for the head of Saint John the Baptist. John the Baptist, who was a prophet, who didn't accept the marriage between Herod and Herodias and was preaching against her. So in the story coming from the Bible, Salome was, again, a tool in the hands of her mother who wanted to take a revenge upon Saint John the Baptist. And then what happens in the second half of the 19th century, the story first gets much more attention than it had before the 19th century. Usually the story of Salome was just presented as one episode in the life of Saint John the Baptist, so her dance, and then when she's offered on a silver platter the severed head of John the Baptist.
Serdecznie dziękuję pani profesor Agnieszce Taborskiej za ten wspaniały wykład, który wygłosiła tutaj na Uniwersytecie imieniem Waszyngtona w Seattle. Wykład był bardzo interesujący i wspaniale pokazany, ilustrowanym malarstwem światowym. No, wykład o kobietach, więc też temat bardzo, bardzo ciekawy. Pani profesor, dziękujemy serdecznie za ten wykład.
No ja dziękuję. Jest bardzo miło być w pięknym mieście w Seattle, gdzie jestem po raz pierwszy. Jestem oczarowana.
Surrealizm. No właśnie, co dla pani znaczy ten kierunek sztuki i właściwie dlaczego surrealizm?
No ja myślę, że ludzie się dzielą często na dwie grupy. Jedna, która lubi bardziej i literaturę realistyczną i filmy dokumentalne i druga, dla której jest ważna wyobraźnia i wszelkie jakieś oniryczne historie. I mnie od początku bardziej interesowała Alicja w Krainie Czarów od Kubusia Puchatka. Także jest to kwestia, myślę, jakichś bardzo wewnętrznych takich predyspozycji, no na zasadzie, że ktoś lubi bardziej kolor czerwony, a ktoś zielony. Ja zawsze mnie bardzo pociągały i filmy, i książki, które właśnie były oparte na wyobraźni. To znaczy nie relacja z życia prawdziwego, ale bardziej to, co się dzieje w wyobraźni człowieka. Mhm.
Co łączy sztuki wizualne z literaturą?
No, pewnie zależy, jaką literaturą i zależy, jakie sztuki wizualne. Na pewno no, podobna wrażliwość, podobna potrzeba pewnego odreagowania na otaczający nas świat, na politykę, na codzienną rzeczywistość. Jest to, oczywiście możemy to nazwać ucieczką, jest to no coś, co nam jest dane, druga rzeczywistość, w czym możemy się odnaleźć albo zgubić. Ale w każdym razie wybudować jakąś barierę między nami, a tym, co się dzieje codziennie wokół nas.
W książce Grzegorza Jankowicza Co to jest sztuka? Wyraziła pani ubolewanie, tak napisał, że śmiertelna jest powaga odbiorców współczesnej sztuki. Dlaczego?
Myślę, że jest rzeczywiście, nie wiem czy śmiertelna, ale w każdym razie widzę i pracując ze studentami i czytając, no właśnie, czytając, że poczucie pewnej ironii i dwuznaczności jest, no mam nadzieję, że nie na wymarciu, ale w każdym razie jest rozumiane nie tak powszechnie, jak było dawniej. No, chociażby reakcje na moją książkę, która jest mistyfikacją i była często traktowana w sposób bardzo, bardzo serio. Mówię o sennym żywocie Leonory de la Cruz, która jest właśnie wyimaginowaną historią i nawet kiedy mówiłam o niej na takiej konferencji, festiwalu literackim o mistyfikacjach literackich we Francji, to moja bohaterka, która jest całkowicie wytworem mojej wyobraźni, została potraktowana bardzo, bardzo serio. Także myślę, że nam wszystkim często brak pewnej lekkości i właśnie wiarę w dwuznaczność, ironię, ale to są pewnie, myślę, takie nurty przejściowe, więc to się na pewno, sądzę, zmieni. Zresztą no, w literaturze w Polsce w tej chwili jest głównie literatura faktu, od wielu lat już najbardziej czytana. Zresztą biografie, no wszędzie są bardzo, bardzo popularne, prawda? Więc z tą wyobraźnią w tej chwili nie jest tak lekko.
Najlepiej powiedziałabym. No właśnie, bo tutaj wracam do tego pytania. Co pani myśli o krytykach, którzy chcieliby właściwie jakoś zamknąć pani twórczość w takich ramach?
Co? No ja myślę, że taka jest rola krytyków. No i powiedzmy...
Ale nie chciała być pani za Kowana.
Nie, ale myślę, że to jest też nie do uniknięcia, no, prawda? To wszyscy twórcy i pisarze i filmowcy oczywiście nie chcą być zaszufladkowani, ale jednocześnie rola krytyki historii literatury jest właśnie taka. Zresztą część artystów sobie z tego świetnie zdaje sprawę i właśnie trudność zaszufladkowania działa często przeciwko, prawda? Bo jest to rzecz taka ułatwiająca rozpoznanie terenu.
Pani opowiadania mają bardzo taki filmowy charakter. Czy miała już pani propozycję, żeby na podstawie tych opowiadań zrobić jakieś filmiki?
Nie miałam. No one są krótkie, one są lapidarne. Były dwa filmy animowane na podstawie moich takich baśni dla dorosłych i dla dzieci, ale są te dwa tomiki opowiadań, czyli Wieloryb albo Przypadek obiektywny i Nie tak jak w raju. A Nie tak jak w raju bardzo niedawno się ukazało.
Właśnie kupiłam.
No bardzo się cieszę. Nie, jeszcze nie miałam. Nawet nie myślałam, że one są filmowe. No ale może są rzeczywiście.
Ktoś mi powiedział, że są.
Tak?
Czy okolica krakowskiego Kazimierza ma dla pani jakieś szczególne znaczenie? Bo właściwie Warszawa jest pani miastem rodzinnym, prawda? A nie Kraków. A jak to się ma właśnie do tego Kazimierza?
Ja nawet bardzo niedawno, tutaj dosłownie dwa dni przed przyjechaniem do Seattle, wysłałam tekst, który napisałam na zamówienie, co mi się, to drugi raz w życiu mi się to zdarzyło, do książki, która się ma ukazać po angielsku na temat właśnie Krakowa. Wyszły już tomy, był tom poświęcony Pradze, Warszawie. A tutaj się zgłosił do mnie redaktor przygotowujący właśnie tom o Krakowie i ja napisałam takie bardzo osobiste opowiadanie o Krakowie. Ten Kazimierz może on trochę przypadkiem rzeczywiście wyniknął w moim wielorybie, bo na Kazimierzu często bywam przez to, no teraz jest tam mój wydawca, jest tam klub taki literacki, lokator, ale Kraków ja rzeczywiście bardzo, bardzo lubię, a Kazimierz, który jest na pewno wciąż mniej turystyczny i bardziej taki pełen bohemii artystycznej. Rzeczywiście bardzo, bardzo się tam dobrze czuję. Ale nie jestem w tym oryginalna, bo większość warszawiaków Warszawy nie lubi, przeprasza za nią. Natomiast krakowiacy czy krakowianie są przekonani, że właśnie nie ma życia poza Krakowem, więc ja jestem pośrodku. Ale jeździć do Krakowa szalenie lubią.
Dziękuję bardzo za rozmowę.